The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purposes of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these televised proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Now we will start orders of the day, oral questions put by members to ministers. It is now 3:09, and we will finish at 4:39. The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for the Premier. Nova Scotia Power's parent company, Emera, continues to collect huge profits, while Nova Scotia ratepayers face the seventh increase in 10 years. And still, Mr. Speaker, the NDP government chooses to sit idly by and do nothing. So my question to the Premier, why has the NDP government chosen not to oppose any rate increases by Nova Scotia Power?
The Honourable the Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I've addressed this question on many occasions now. It's not true. In fact, we're going to be there at the hearing in order to make sure that the rate base, Mr. Speaker, it justifies the request that they put forward to the Utility and Review Board. Thank you.
The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, it is true. Not only has this caucus asked that question to the Premier, so has the Conservative caucus, and each and every time the Premier says he'll send somebody there, but he does not commit to opposing any rate increase by Nova Scotia Power on the rate base to Nova Scotians, Mr. Speaker. Homeowners are worried. Businesses are concerned about the proposed rate increases. The NDP has created an environment that is not affordable to live in, and an environment that is not competitive to do business. Mr. Speaker, the Premier is opposed to intervening on rate increases, and he is opposed to a performance audit of Nova Scotia Power. So my question to the Premier, how is he going to rein in increased power costs Nova Scotians are facing?
Honourable the Premier.
Again, Mr. Speaker, I have to say, none of that is true. They keep saying it. It is not true, Mr. Speaker. And I would just remind, Mr. Speaker, the Leader of the Opposition, that it was the Liberal government that created the separate companies of Emera and Nova Scotia Power.
The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, it was a Liberal government that has stood up for Nova Scotia ratepayers whenever Nova Scotia Power was looking for a rate increase. All we're simply doing is asking the Premier to do his job, and that is to stand up to Nova Scotia Power and protect Nova Scotians, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the top 12 executives of Nova Scotia Power were paid a total of $3.18 million last year. Mr. Speaker, I want to quote the Premier from April of 2007, and I quote, "Ratepayers shouldn't have to pay for exorbitant executive compensation," end of quote. Mr. Speaker, the performance audit that we've asked the Premier to initiate with Nova Scotia Power would review these exorbitant executive compensation that he referred to in 2007, plus many other parts of their operation. My question to the Premier, why is he opposed to this audit?
Honourable the Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I am not opposed to a performance audit. In fact, that power resides with the Utility and Review Board. We intend to be there, Mr. Speaker, to ensure, Mr. Speaker, that whatever the case is made by Nova Scotia Power, that it is justified. Furthermore, Mr. Speaker, we did the one thing that tangibly affects the rates for people in this province. We took the HST off a home energy.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, my question is for the Minister of Health. During estimates this session, Mr. Speaker, the Minister spoke at great length about the work of her department, but she didn't mention that the estimates for the Department of Health and for all of the health budget for all the DHAs contains a provision of exactly zero for health equipment for the upcoming year. Mr. Speaker, this may be an error. I'm willing to entertain the possibility that it's an error, that the estimate shows zero for health equipment this year. This is the provision that is usually made for diagnostic imaging equipment, for cardiac cath lab equipment, for surgical lighting and other pieces of equipment, either new or for those that break during the year. It seems kind of incredible to budget that nothing is going to break in our entire health system during the upcoming year. And so my question to the minister is this: is this an error in the budget? Or if not, why have you eliminated all the funding for medical equipment for the upcoming year, which is clearly an unrealistic expectation?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and I want to thank the Honourable Member for the question. Mr. Speaker, I want to assure Nova Scotians that our hospitals are well equipped to ensure the best care for patients in this province. And Mr. Speaker, as part of our plan to get back to balance, it is the case that capital budgets have been reduced. But Mr. Speaker, this certainly does not mean that equipment that requires replacing will not be replaced or maintained, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, thank you. I will table that page from the estimate book. I've circled the zero amount. Reduced is reduced. Zero is zero. Over the last few years, in fact, the average of the last 3 years, the province has spent repairing and replacing health equipment an average of about $24 million a year. Surely, in the real world, we can all agree something is going to break during the year, and yet it'll have to be replaced, and yet the government has made no provision for that. And so my question to the minister is this: since she insists that the budget must be zero, what does she advise our hospitals to do? Leave it broken, leave the equipment broken and take it out of circulation? And advise them that they should fund it through their operating grants that the department provides? Or perhaps she'll be providing them with duct tape and crazy glue to try and keep the equipment going?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, it's very important to recognize that this government provides district health authorities with $1.6 billion annually to operate. And of those operating grants, the district health authorities allocate money to replace, repair, maintain equipment. The Capital District Health Authority, for example, has $2 million allocated in their budget for this purpose, Mr. Speaker. So as I said, Nova Scotians should be reassured that hospitals are well equipped to deal with the health care needs of citizens in this province, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party on your final supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I am amazed at what I've just heard. Clearly, a government that loves strategies has no plan for the maintenance of our health equipment in our hospitals. They require that hospital foundations raise 25% of the money to match the government grants, but now there is zero to match, Mr. Speaker. The fact of the matter is the grants, the operating grants to the hospitals are for operations. They've frozen that amount this year. They've asked the hospitals to absorb the cost of inflation. They've asked the hospitals to absorb any wage increases, which is a cut in real terms. And now, if I understand the minister's answer correctly, there is a hidden $24 million further cut to our operating grants. So my question to the minister is this: if she is asking our hospitals to fund their equipment purchases and repairs out of that operating grant, would she agree she's cut the hospital budget by a further $20 to $24 million?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, I never heard such a ridiculous proposition in all my life, Mr. Speaker. I mean, talk about hiding the capital grants in the estimates of the budget. For gosh sakes, this comes to the floor of this House, and we have discussion right here. So there's nothing being hidden, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, in addition to the $1.6 billion we give to the capital or to the various health authorities, Mr. Speaker, there's a $72 million for capital grants this year for the use on smaller projects and purchases, Mr. Speaker. So I would again reiterate that Nova Scotians need to be reassured our hospitals are well equipped and we will not see any equipment that requires replacement or repairs left unattended to, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Colchester North.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question through you is to the Minister of Education. Last night, representatives from the Cape Breton Regional School Board met to hear from 14 permanent teachers who have just been notified that they were laid off. These layoffs come as a direct result of the Department of Education's funding cuts to school boards. These teachers had just a few minutes to state their case as to why they should not be laid off. It is an incredibly emotional situation, and it shows the impact of the minister's funding cuts. So my question to the minister is this. Did the minister show enough interest and make any attempt to gather the statements from these teachers from last night?
The Honourable Minister of Education.
Thank you very much. I see that the Honourable Member had to wait for her turn to ask a question because I think she forgot which side of the House she was sitting on there. I noticed she stood up in the last. I want to say that this is a very serious situation. We have people.
Order, please. Order. The Honourable Minister has the floor.
We have a very serious situation and people's lives have been affected. Unfortunately, because of declining enrollment, we do not need as many teachers in our system. It's a very unfortunate situation. I have to say, though, that the Honourable Member does know that this was an in-camera meeting, and that is something between the school boards and the people that were there, that I would not receive those statements. That is in-camera. Those are private conversations that the teachers have. I would imagine, Mr. Speaker, that this must have been a very difficult process for those teachers, and it's a very unfortunate situation. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Colchester North on your first supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. 44 probationary teachers from the Halifax Regional School Board will appear tonight before their school board's committee meeting. And these are teachers that were one step away from becoming permanent teachers. Instead, they were told they're laid off. The minister will claim these layoffs were not her decision, and now she's trying to blame it on declining enrollment. But the fact remains that these layoffs are the result of her decision. And you know, Mr. Speaker, although this is an in-camera meeting, quote, interested parties are allowed to attend. That interested party, Mr. Speaker, could be the Minister of Education. So, Mr. Speaker, will the minister support teachers in this province by attending the in-camera meeting tonight to hear the impact that her decision is having on our classroom and our teachers?
The Honourable Minister of Education.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. You know, this is a very difficult time. We have declining enrollment in the province, and as the Honourable Member knows, that within the provisions of the collective agreement, that when teachers are displaced in one board, they through the collective agreement, be relocated. Now, that's not the answer to the heartache that these teachers are going through. But we do have provisions to be able to provide teachers the opportunity to go to a board where we are going to be hiring because of attrition. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Colchester North, on your final supplementary, please.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, for the information of the House, declining enrollment is accommodated through the HOG formula. This is in addition to declining enrollment in the HOG formula. Mr. Speaker, these teachers will be given 5 minutes to state the work of their profession and the impact that their cut will have on the classrooms. These are young teachers who have worked incredibly hard to earn their degrees. They have spent time in the system and were about to become permanent teachers, only to be laid off. So my question to the minister is this. When in the history of Nova Scotia have teachers been forced to appeal their case before the school board because the minister has cut funding for teaching and learning in this province?
The Honourable Minister of Education.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And as I've said, this is a very unfortunate situation. And I know that it's very difficult for those teachers this evening that will be speaking on behalf of the situation that we have found ourselves in this province. Unfortunately, we are losing our children coming into our school system. We are going to lose 2,500 students in our system this year. Very unfortunate, and I apologize for the heartache that many families are going through during this time, but we are in a situation where we have declining enrollment and we do not need as many teachers as we used to. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Richmond.
Mr. Speaker, access to justice is an essential part of a well-functioning justice system. For low-income Nova Scotians, this can be a significant challenge. In fact, for low-income families, trying to access legal representation for separation, divorce, or child custody matters, the Nova Scotia legal aid system has been there for them. And my question to the Minister of Justice is, why did the Minister order a $553,000 cut to the Nova Scotia legal aid funding?
Honourable the Minister of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for that question. The adjustment was mainly to do with external purchasing of legal counsel to deal with cases, and we're going to readjust our internal process, and the Director of Legal Services said that they can handle those cases internally. So it's a matter of making dollars work smarter. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, I think it's time this minister realized that a cut is a cut is a cut. What they're taking away means less services that are going to be available to Nova Scotians. But rather than listen to me, maybe I can quote another member of this House for the minister, where it says, there needs to be additional money in legal aid services to allow people who are unable to afford the services of a lawyer to get access to those services as well, because the system really functions much more efficiently when the people who are caught up in the system have fair access to those resources. Mr. Speaker, that's a quote from March 20th, 2007 from the Honourable Premier of Nova Scotia when he was a member of the opposition. So my question to the minister, how are you improving access to justice for Nova Scotians of low income when you cut $553,000 from Nova Scotia legal aid budget?
The Honourable Minister.
Well, order please. The member is using the word you. That is out of order. You know, I've explained that we're going to follow proper parliamentary procedure in this House. I had a protocol note distributed to all the House leaders for each caucus explaining why this is to be followed. I've asked the members to I'll ask the member to rephrase the question and other members to do that, okay? The requirement to use titles and use third persons is uniform throughout the Westminster-based parliaments. I'd ask you to rephrase the question.
How does the minister justify a cut of $553,000 to the Nova Scotia legal aid funding after the comments made by his own leader?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And as I stated yesterday in one of my questions, I alluded to the fact of understanding the full picture of the issue before us. And what I'm referring to is the member across the way is making the assumption that spending more money gets results. And what I'm saying is that we spoke with the Director of Legal Services, and they looked at their process and they put a more strategic plan in place within their departments on how to manage this and not exporting the service outside of the department so that they can fulfill the needs inside. Should there be issues of concern down the road, we'll evaluate them at that time. But this government, Mr. Minister, Mr. Speaker, and this minister is committed to sound fiscal management. It is unfortunate that the opposition doesn't think the same way.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your final supplementary.
Well, let me be helpful to the minister again, because maybe the words of another one of his colleagues will help him understand that it's not simply us who are concerned with cuts made to the Nova Scotia legal aid funding. One of the important issues is the income cap that applies to who qualifies for legal aid, which has not been touched in quite some time. And the quote says, the qualifying income for legal aid is so low now that essentially anybody who's working doesn't qualify for legal aid. Even if you're working full-time at minimum wage, you would still earn too much to qualify for legal aid. So you have this whole stratum of society that doesn't qualify for legal aid and yet can't afford a lawyer, and there's an enormous gap in between these two. Mr. Speaker, those words were spoken in Hansard, November 18, 2008, by the Honourable Member for Fairview, Halifax Fairview, who's now the Minister of Finance. This is the same Minister of Finance who decided to increase 1,400 user fees by the cost of living. So I would ask if the Minister of Finance would explain how does he justify increasing 1,400 user fees and not increase the income cap for low-income Nova Scotians to qualify for Nova Scotia legal aid.
The Honourable Minister of Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I refer that to the Minister of Justice.
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The assumption being made by my colleague on the opposite side of the floor is that the service is going to deteriorate. And I'm standing here today that it's not. And that we're working smarter and we're being good custodians of the taxpayers' money. And should there be critical issues or need, we'll evaluate them case by case as we move forward. It's very important, Mr. Speaker, that we protect the taxpayers' dollars, that our departments are managed to the best of our ability, and that we have confidence in the system, and I have confidence in the system. It's unfortunate that my colleague does not.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party.
Mr. Speaker, my question is for the Minister of Health. A moment ago, in answer to my previous question, the minister indicated that if a piece of equipment breaks in our health system, even though there's no provision for it in her budget, that she'll take it out of the $72,056,000 health infrastructure budget, which is clearly listed as being for hospital renovations and construction projects, not for equipment. And so my question to the minister is, since this amount is fully accounted for right down to the last dollar in a list of projects, which exact health renovation or construction project is she proposing to set aside if by some crazy chance a piece of equipment actually breaks during the upcoming year?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, there's a very broad range of equipment used in our healthcare system, from small items to relatively large items. Mr. Speaker, quite often with the larger items, the project money for those items comes from the capital grants because they also require the sort of infrastructure around the housing of pieces of equipment. So that fund is a $72 million fund, and it is not an exclusive fund only for building projects, but is also often used for capital equipment and will be in this case as well, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party on your first supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, this is clearly a new budgeting practice by the government where funds may or may not be used for what they've been stated for in the estimates of the province. And so my question for the minister is this, just as one example, A piece of diagnostic imaging equipment, a CAT scanner, for example, or a PET scanner, can run into $5-6 million plus installation, plus training. If we should lose one of those pieces of equipment, is it the minister's advice to our hospitals and health authorities that they set aside some other infrastructure need in order to keep that piece of equipment in use during the year?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to get into debating hypothetical situations around specific pieces of equipment here on the floor of the House. I have said, Mr. Speaker, that our hospitals are well equipped. Last year, we spent $20 million on equipping hospitals across the province. An additional expenditures were made by hospital foundations. As well, there's money contained within the DHA budgets for capital equipment. Mr. Speaker, there have been reductions in our capital budget because we inherited an incredible mess from the previous government. Everybody knows that, and that means we have to find ways to maintain health care services, but at the same time, we need to get back to balance, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Leader of the official, the Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party, on your final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What is at issue here is the management ability of the current government.
That's right.
And this is not hypothetical, because common sense tells us that sometime during the year, a piece of needed equipment is going to break. That is what this estimate line item was supposed to be for. In fact, just to give you an example, Mr. Speaker, at Capitol Health today, there are dialysis machines, half of which are in need of replacement, one of which is going to go at any time, and we're going to need a provision for its replacement. So my question to the minister is this. If her answer is we'll take it out of somewhere else, then why not just produce realistic budgets in the first place?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, as I indicated, Capitol Health in their budget have $2 million for repairs and replacement of capital equipment, Mr. Speaker. And additionally, we have another $72 million available to the district health authorities for capital projects and small equipment replacement and repairs. And Mr. Speaker, this will be an adequate amount of money to help us maintain the equipment in our system and ensure that Nova Scotians get the best care possible, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Richmond.
Mr. Speaker, last week the long-awaited immigration strategy was finally released. While it is in the best interest of our province that the strategy succeeds, specific action items lack details in certain sections of the report. Mr. Speaker, the most recent Statistics Canada information produced earlier this year, Nova Scotia was home to 3,394 international students. The new strategy calls for information sessions about work programs, welcome events, expansion of the Connector program, and encouraging employers to participate in co-op programs. My question to the Minister responsible for the Office of Immigration, has she reviewed what other jurisdictions are doing to retain international students once they graduate?
The Honourable Minister of Labour and Advanced Education.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Certainly, our staff have been reviewing best practices across Canadian jurisdictions and elsewhere throughout the world. And certainly, a study done by the Maritime Commission on Higher Education has indicated that in the short term, the tremendous economic boost that international students provide. Also, we retain a significant number of them as because they fall in love with the province, they want to stay here and raise their families and start their careers. So it appears that attracting them in a number of different ways is the best way of making sure that they have a good opportunity to learn more about the province, getting engaged with organizations, feeling supported by cultural communities, and also getting more information about where the labour market opportunities are. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your first supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, attracting and retaining, I haven't heard the word retaining, which hopefully the Minister is focused on as well. Last September, the province of Manitoba made changes to their strategy by allowing international graduates to apply to the provincial nominee program in advance of receiving an offer of employment. Our strategy, unfortunately, has made no such changes. Currently in Nova Scotia, before an international graduate can apply to the provincial nominee program, they must have a permanent job offer related to their field of study. Mr. Speaker, we all know in Nova Scotia, job search could be extensive, and the risk of losing these graduates to other jurisdictions remains high if we don't do all we can to ensure that they stay in our province. So my question to the Minister is, why didn't we see Manitoba's change when it comes to international graduates become applicable here in Nova Scotia under the new immigration strategy?
The Honourable Minister of Labour and Advanced Education.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think probably the best answer I can give is that we're trying to take a very measured, balanced approach. This is a strategy. It's not the final implementation action plan of the strategy. We'll be taking the steps that we feel will be very positive, talking more closely to international students and some of the the sponsors within the universities, and gradually making improvements and changes as necessary. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your final supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, we've waited almost 2 years to get a strategy, and now the minister says it's not actually what they're going to follow, it's just a mere guide. This isn't a difficult one that I'm suggesting here, Minister. It's actually already being done in Manitoba. The fear that students who graduate who are unable to immediately find work don't qualify to stay in Nova Scotia is clearly a gap that needs to be addressed, and it wouldn't be very difficult for the minister to address that. I do realize there is an issue in that they would be applying under the provincial nominee program, which we know the federal government has capped at $500 a year for Nova Scotia. As soon as our premier realizes that it's actually the prime minister who he should be talking to about having this cap lifted, this should no longer be an issue. But my question, again, finally to the minister, are you prepared to adopt the same strategy used by Manitoba and allow, is the minister prepared to adopt the same strategy, the same strategy as Manitoba has, to allow international graduate students upon graduation to apply to stay and remain as permanent residents of Nova Scotia, even if they have not secured a permanent job?
The Honourable Minister of Labour and Advanced Education.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Encouraging international students to become part of the nominee program is just one of many, many aspects of our strategy. As I said, we're going to be taking a close look at any improvements that might have to happen. I just want to add also that there's been ongoing discussions among senior officials, deputy ministers, and ministers with our federal counterparts on the matter of immigration caps. The House may be interested to know that Nova Scotia has is the co-lead with the federal minister on immigration, and so we have additional opportunities to discuss with our counterparts in Ottawa the impacts. We have strongly suggested, as has the Council of Atlantic Premiers, that we need an equitable distribution of the caps across the country, and that it's in the best interest, we feel, of all Atlantic Canada, but especially Nova Scotia, to be able to bring in more immigrants. They create jobs, they fill much-needed worker and skill shortages, and this is something we take very seriously, and we know that this new strategy is going to make a big difference. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Argyle.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Talks broke off yesterday between Nova Scotia's largest health authority, Capital Health, and the NSGEU, representing the nurses of Local 97, who recommended the nurses reject the government's 1% pay raise. This government, of course, vowed in the fall of 2009 that it would hold annual wage increases to 1%. Mr. Speaker, my question to you, to the Minister of Health, is this government still committed to the 1% wage settlements, even if it cost a potentially lengthy nurses strike?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and I want to thank the Honourable Member for the question. Mr. Speaker, we very much value the work of the nurses in the Capital District Health Authority and across the province. And Mr. Speaker, we also, as a government, believe in the collective bargaining process, and we want the collective bargaining process to work in the interests of the province, and that process is underway, Mr. Speaker, and we're hopeful that a resolution will be reached in the process. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Argyle on your first supplementary.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. According to a statement released by the NSGEU posted on their website, an email was sent from the Capital District Health Authority stating that Local 97 was offered the same agreement that was recently ratified by Local Number 42. The union points out two specific examples of discrepancies between the two agreements. Mr. Speaker, nurses play a vital role in patient care and comfort and deserve to know the truth about the offer on the table, and I can table the document as well. Mr. Speaker, my question to you, to the minister, is the minister aware of the inaccuracies sent out by the VP at the Health Authority and what is being done to help keep nurses from a strike position?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, as I indicated, we very much value the work of nurses in the Capital District as well as all across the province. And the collective bargaining process is underway, Mr. Speaker, and I'm hopeful we'll reach a resolution through that process.
The Honourable Member from Argyle on your final supplementary.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and we too hope that there'll be a resolution to this one before the possible strike. But the possible strike is looming, Mr. Speaker, and the care of our vulnerable, ill Nova Scotians is the biggest concern right now. Nova Scotians need reassurance that we'll continue to have access to these imperative healthcare services. So, Mr. Speaker, my question through you to the minister is, what's the government's contingency plan to ensure the care and safety of Nova Scotia's patients?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I'd like to reassure Nova Scotians that this government, unlike previous governments, respect the collective bargaining process. And Mr. Speaker, we are hopeful that that process will lead to a resolution. And Mr. Speaker, there are still a number of steps that are left to proceed through in that process, and we're hoping that at the end of the day a resolution will be achieved. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton South.
Thank you very much. Mr. Speaker, my question today is for the Deputy Premier. Mr. Speaker, as MLA for Cape Breton Centre for 13 years and Cabinet Minister for almost two, the Deputy Premier is more than aware of the important staff play when it comes to ensuring success. For Cabinet Ministers, the role of an executive assistant is vitally important, Mr. Speaker. These individuals meet with stakeholders, they act as gatekeepers, they assist a minister with daily agendas, and they provide support when it comes to the development of public policy. My question to the Deputy Premier, Mr. Speaker, can the Deputy Premier please indicate whether an executive assistant provides support to Cabinet Ministers in the form of political advice?
The Honourable the Deputy Premier.
Mr. Speaker, I'm looking through my hot book, but I can't find a note on that one. But Mr. Speaker, I'll assure you that I am not privy to each and every conversation that every EA has with their minister, so I wouldn't be aware of that, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton South,
on
your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, well, we do know one thing when it comes to government. Many of the EAs arrived in their positions via a secondment from the NDP caucus office, ensuring government's intent in seeking someone political for the position. Mr. Speaker, on September 20, 2009, the Deputy Premier indicated government's intention to freeze the salaries of political staffers for a period of 2 years by issuing a press release. And I'll table that press release, Mr. Speaker. Yet a FOIPOP received in our office shows that at least three EAs received increases to the tune of 25%, 24%, and 20% since government made that public announcement. So despite government's promise to the people they would freeze salaries for political staffers, this government somehow feels it is justifiable to raise the salaries of some political staff in significant amounts. My question to the Deputy Premier, how can the Deputy Premier justify increases of 20, 24, and 20% salaries of when they said the salaries of political workers would be frozen?
Honourable the Deputy Premier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, it's quite simple that when someone moves from one job, say in the assertion of the question, that you move from your job at caucus office or from wherever and go into a new job as an EA, there would quite be a possible that there be a salary change. Thank you.
The Honourable Member For Cape Breton South, on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, again, the Deputy Premier was quoted in the Cape Breton Post on September 21st stating the following, and I'll table that as well. September 21st, 2009. Mr. Speaker, this is not, the quote is, and I'll quote, "This is not us grandstanding, it's just doing the right thing," close quote. On the same date, September 21st, this same Deputy Minister stated, "We're going to have to be frugal, and I guess we're going to have to kind of lead by example." Given increases that average 23% is not leading by example. My final question to the Deputy Premier, will the Deputy Premier now admit his comments made almost 2 years ago were nothing more than political optics, and indeed this government has failed to lead by example?
Honourable the Deputy Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think my counterparts are right in answering this for me across the way. It's not true. Mr. Speaker, what we have done is again, there were the positions they inherited, Mr. Speaker, and positions that we paid a heck of a lot less to people than the other government before us, Mr. Speaker. So, I mean, this was people incumbent to jobs. No EA got a job the way the question was premised. They inherited the job, and that was the rate of salary they inherited. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton West.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, my question to you will be to the Minister of Transportation and Infrastructure Renewal. It's spring in Nova Scotia, so that means that potholes are making travel on some dirt roads dangerous, Mr. Speaker. My question to the Minister of Transportation and Infrastructure Renewal is this. If Nova Scotians live or travel on a road that they believe presents a danger to motorists, what should they do and what actions should they expect from the department staff?
The Honourable Minister of Transportation Infrastructure Renewal.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the member opposite for the question. It's a rough time of year, and there are some real hard conditions, situations around the province that have been brought to my attention, particularly when it comes to gravel roads that are going to have to be graded. This time, it's that heavy equipment just can't get on those roads. I do know that trucks are trying to get in there sometimes with some gravel. I would urge that people in those situations would contact the local depot, contact the local base, find out when the grader is going to be on the road, and be patient.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton West on your first supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, as the Minister knows, because I've had him on this particular road, people who live on the Grandmire South Road are fed up. They estimate that there are 200 potholes on the road this year, and they say that condition isn't much better than last year. And one man's vehicle sustained $900 in damage from traveling on this road. When local department staff were contacted, they said that the road will get attention in due course. My question to you, to the Minister, is this. How bad does the Grandmire South Road have to get before the department makes an effort to make some kind of short-term improvements to that road?
The Honourable Minister of Transportation Infrastructure Renewal.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the member for the question, and that was one of the roads in your constituency that I had the opportunity to be on. If we recall the time of year that it was firmer now than it is now, of course, because of conditions in the spring.
Order, please. Again, we seem to be going back to using the word you. Your apologies. I would ask the member to rephrase their question and any others that you may answer in this question period. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry for the you there. The member opposite has got a great example of a road because when we were on it together, I understand that the member brought to my attention the concern what happens when the spring arrives. Mr. Speaker, as you're well aware of, there are certain roads in this province that are in difficult shape this time of the year. We're doing everything possible. We'll make sure the roads are safe as soon as we can get on them. But when you're dealing with heavy equipment, as the member opposite knows, we're having difficulty this time of the year bringing them up to shape.
The Honourable Member for Cape Breton West on your final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I want to thank the Minister for that answer. And Mr. Speaker, Jerry Gardner, a 69-year-old retired resident of Grandmire South, is so frustrated by the poor condition of the road that he has taken matters into his own hands.
For the second year in a row, Mr. Gardner, who his neighbors call the Grandmire Road Crew, is going down the road filling potholes with gravel, spreading them out with a rake. He says that if he wins the lotto, he will spend his winnings on road improvements. Mr. Speaker, my question to you, to the minister, is this. I'm sure the minister can see the many safety and practical problems about having a taxpayer doing road work. I'm sure the minister can understand the level of frustration of the residents in the Grandmire South Road when they feel they must take such drastic measures. Will the minister make a commitment today to take a special interest in the Grandmire South Road and ensure the needed repairs are made as soon as possible?
The Honourable Minister of Transportation Infrastructure Renewal.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the member opposite for the question. I wish that the opportunity would be there for me to have met Mr. Gardner, as was arranged with another meeting at that time. But you know, I really would urge that constituents in Cape Breton West and other parts of the province be very careful about going out and doing that initiative. It could be a very dangerous day, although I know that Mr. Gardner has experience with such challenges when he worked on the roads himself as a contractor. I would please ask him to desist from doing the job that he's doing, to contact the department, and we'll try to work together to bring the Grandmire Road up. And as, when it comes to Cape Breton West, I think the member opposite is well aware of the fact that the roads in his area do receive special attention for some other reasons. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, my question is for the Minister of Energy. Yesterday, the Department of Energy announced they are seeking nominations for a new Wholesale Market Advisory Committee, which is fine, except for the fact that this work has already been done twice. The Electricity Marketplace Governance Committee final report was released October 2003, and the Green Attribute Administration report was released in September 2006. And that's not even counting the government's own renewable energy strategy. So, Mr. Speaker, why is the government seeking new advice on wholesale electricity markets when it's already been done at least twice by this government in the past 8 years?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the Honourable Member for the question. It's important as a department to have the very latest information, to be up to date, to know what's going on, and that's exactly why we've called for this advice.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East on your first supplementary.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. It just seems a bit strange that we would go out and create redundancy in this area. It looks like the government just wants to keep getting reports done until it gets the advice it wants. And I say that because neither the NDP nor the Tory governments have implemented many of the recommendations from the first two reports. So why bother doing another study on the same subject and get a third report that says the same thing for the third time? So, Mr. Speaker, will the minister commit to actually implementing the recommendations of the study this time around?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As you know, market conditions are constantly changing. That's certainly why we're trying to get this information. We'll hopefully have good advice and take it under advisement and act on it accordingly.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East on your final supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, of course the market conditions are changing all the time, but the first two reports, neither this government nor the previous government implemented those, so why would anybody think they're going to implement the third ones? It baffles the mind that that this government would commission a third version on recommendations of the wholesale electricity market, given that the last two reports had almost identical recommendations and weren't implemented. Independent studies since then have continued to recommend the same things, yet the government still has not implemented them. And in fact, had they been, Nova Scotians today might very well be enjoying not only a better electricity market, but perhaps lower prices and certainly more stable prices. So, Mr. Speaker, does the minister actually expect to receive different advice this time, or is this just about trying to make it look like the NDP are doing something on energy issues?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, obviously, I can't prejudge what advice we're going to get, but we're confident that the information that come to us will be first rate, and we're going to have to judge it on its own merit, of course. But it's been over 5 years since the last report, and we certainly need an updated version of where we're at. And this is 2011, and I think it was 2007 or before the previous report. So let's judge it on its merit when we receive it.
The Honourable Member for Halifax Clayton Park.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for the Minister of Health and Wellness. As the Minister is well aware, Capital Health nurses represented by NSGEU voted 94% in favour of strike action last week. And today we learned that conciliation broke off last night and the union is recommending that its membership reject the government's offer. Last week, I asked the Minister to update the House on the status of the contingency plan should the 2,500 nurses within the Capital District go on strike. The issue has now become more serious and pressing. Given that the Minister has had almost a week to act since I last posed the question, my question through you, Mr. Speaker, is, has the Minister spoken directly to the Capital Health District Authority about contingency plans that they may have in the event of a strike?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, as I said to one of the other members earlier today, we value the work of nurses in the Capital District. We are very much committed to a successful collective bargaining process, and we're hopeful that that process will lead to a settlement. We are a number of steps away from being in a situation where we're looking at a labour dispute at this time, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Halifax Clayton Park on your first supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and we definitely, all members of the House, support the work of nurses and value their work. And what we're talking about here today is just taking some prudent steps towards, making contingency plans and being ready in the event of a strike. So my question to the Minister is, will the Minister please indicate whether she is satisfied that the contingency plans in place will protect patients if we do, in fact, face a strike in Capital Health District?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I'm pleased to tell the House that I have, I think, very good relations both with the head of the nurses' unions and the CEOs at the District Health Authority. These are issues that we have discussed many times. In fact, I think, Mr. Speaker, it's something that I felt strongly about discussing before we ever got to a stage where we're threatened by the potential of a strike, and that is that we assure that we have strong essential services in our healthcare system in the event of labor disruptions. And Mr. Speaker, as I said, we're still quite some ways from the potential of a labor disruption. But I am very encouraged that we still have a strong collective bargaining process, and I would like to see that process work to the benefit of everyone involved, Mr. Speaker.
And the Honourable Member for Halifax Clayton Park on your final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And we acknowledge that there are a couple more steps left, but we're one step closer to a strike this week than we were last. The union is recommending a rejection of the offer that's on the table. Nurses working in mental health, public health, critical care, transplants, corrections, occupational health, nurse educators and rehabilitation have said to the government that they didn't like the first offer, and 3 days after conciliation, they still have not resolved this situation. Patients who rely on these essential services are wondering who will provide for them in the event of a strike. Today's media reports simply heighten that anxiety. So my question to the Minister is, given the fact that she's already spoken to us and to the House here today, that she's had discussions with the CEOs and is assured herself, could she please table to the House today, before the end of business, a copy of the contingency plan that is in place should the nurses go on strike?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, once again, I too value the work of all of the nurses in the Capital District, irrespective of the type of nursing they provide, whether they're in public health, a very important aspect of our healthcare system, or in the intensive care units, equally as critical, Mr. Speaker. But these nurses, their bargaining agent, are in the collective bargaining process, and I'm hopeful that that collective bargaining process will result in a positive outcome, and I want that process to proceed without any undue stress on the public, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth North.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Today my question is for the Minister of Justice. Mr. Speaker, as many of us are aware, there's been a rash of recent violent crimes, and in particular those including guns, in the Halifax Regional Municipality. In fact, Mr. Speaker, to date, we already have 8 homicides this year in comparison to 12 murders in all of 2010. So today, Mr. Speaker, Halifax Regional Council has reached out publicly to ask the Minister and his department for help. So can the Minister today explain how and what plans his department might have to assist Halifax Regional Council in addressing the increasing numbers of violent gun crimes in our communities?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
I'd like to thank the member for that question. And the issue of violence in the community, as I've stated in this House before, is something that's very important to me. I'm very concerned. And in that regard is that our staff is continually meeting with the various policing agencies. And we recently, as a fact today, a letter actually went out, but we had it prepared the other day, to the mayor and council, the mayor of Halifax, to meet and along. And I spoke today with the Chief of Police and with the RCMP. So it's an ongoing issue. We take great concern in this, and I thank him for the question.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth North on your first supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, this isn't the first time Regional Council has reached out to the Minister. On February 21st, a letter from the Commissioner Earl Goss, Chair of the HRM Board of Police Commissioners, wrote to the Minister regarding additional officer programs. In the letter that was supported also by the regional councillors, Mr. Goss expressed, and I quote, "The additional officer program plays an important role in ensuring Nova Scotia is a safe and secure place to work and live. The program has allowed HRM to deploy officers to some of our most vulnerable communities. These communities are experiencing the effects of poverty, discrimination, and isolation. Many are struggling with drug trafficking and related violence. The program has had a direct impact on the violence in these communities and others." And I'll table that, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, on March 4th, the response by the Minister stated that severe financial challenges were being experienced by the province and that he could not ensure the program will remain. So my question to the Minister, can he assure the House today that during the review of this program, he'll consider both the role HRM plays in public safety in Nova Scotia and the impact that these officers have made in the communities that they serve?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you very much, and once again, thank you to the member for that question. I did respond on March 4th to Mr. Goss in regards to his initial letter, and I had subsequently had a follow-up meeting with Mr. Goss, and at that time I advised him and others that were from various police commissions that, in fact, the program for this year was not being touched. So the request that he had put forth had been met.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth North on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, a recent article in The Coast uncovered some alarming figures regarding the Pinecrest-Highfield Park areas of my community. Analysis of police call data showed that 7% of all police calls for serious incidents from 2005 to 2010 are in the areas of Highfield and Pinecrest. Among the most common incidents, assaults, robberies, drug use, weapons, and attempted suicides. So, Mr. Speaker, through you, can the Minister today commit to me to have a tour of my community with my local community constable as soon as the House arises?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you to the member for that question. As I stated in the House before, and I think that question was asked last year, similar, my position is the same. Just contact my office to organize that. My position hasn't changed from that point. I will be more than happy to accompany him or others in the office, and I extend that invitation out to others in the House. I am very concerned and committed to policing in this province and the safety of all Nova Scotians, and if you feel there's a need for me to get that exposure, I'd be more than happy to see that we accommodate that.
The Honourable Member for Clayton Park.
Mr. Speaker, my question is for the Minister of Health and Wellness. A well-integrated tobacco control strategy is one built on the premise that we reduce smoking rates. In order to do this, government can place its emphasis on two key groups of people: those who are younger and have not yet started to smoke but are at risk to do so, and those who have been smoking for a number of years. Both are equally important and both require equal attention by government. My question to the minister is this, Mr. Speaker. When consulting around the new tobacco control strategy, did the minister receive feedback indicating government should do more to assist current smokers?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, there was extensive consultation in the development of the tobacco strategy with numerous groups. And Mr. Speaker, I think it is a very good strategy. I'm pleased with the endorsements we've received from district health authorities, Doctors Nova Scotia, Cancer Care Nova Scotia, Smoke-Free Nova Scotia, and the Canadian Cancer Society. And I'm looking forward to the work implementing this strategy over the next 5 years, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Halifax, Clayton Park, on your first supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And the long-awaited tobacco control strategy certainly is another step forward, and we appreciate that. But it does contain 69 action items. And of those 69 action items, only one action item speaks to the importance of helping people quit smoking in an action-oriented way. Mr. Speaker, we know from Health Canada's reports that 3 months after a smoker quits smoking, their risk of heart attack drops. In 5 to 15 years after quitting, the stroke risk is reduced to that of a non-smoker. Mr. Speaker, heart attacks, strokes, and other health implications add significant cost to our health care system. It makes sense that we should be putting more resources into preventing those future cost burdens on our health care system. So again, as I said, Mr. Speaker, of 69 action items, only one relates to helping quit smoking. The others are general vision items and generally relating to stop having people never start to smoke. So my question to the minister, Mr. Speaker, is why does this strategy mention only one action item that speaks to the need of investing in support to help people quit so that we can save money in the future?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, the member is correct in saying that there are multiple ways to address tobacco control. One is to keep people from ever becoming addicted to tobacco, and the other is to work with people who already are addicted to help them kick the habit, Mr. Speaker. And this strategy contains measures to address both of those concerns, Mr. Speaker. And additionally, we have identified the need to have better information and then action approaches to some groups that are marginalized, that have persistently high rates of tobacco use, such as people with mental health disorders, Mr. Speaker, and people from low-income groups. And as of yet, the specific activities that would target those groups have not been spelt out because the research needs to be conducted to help us establish what is the best approach to get at those more persistent and difficult groups of smokers, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Halifax, Clayton Park, on your final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And what we're really asking for here is some balance and trying to balance those two aims and the two different groups of people that the strategy should speak to. And our belief is that there should be more emphasis on helping people quit, because the DHAs today will run out of money before the year ends every year on their smoking cessation plans. They're not able to help people as the year advances because the money is used up. So we're not not helping at that end to the extent that we should. And in, Mr. Speaker, it's not a question of not having enough money, because I mentioned last week there are $200 million plus that we collect every year in taxes related to tobacco, and there was a $25 million settlement in just one legal case that the province benefited from. So we have the money, we should be investing it. And my question to the minister, Mr. Speaker, given that the minister wants evidence to guide spending decisions, and given that there is a mountain of clinical evidence showing that we can save money on future health care costs by helping people to quit smoking, why hasn't the minister added any new monies to the strategy to do so?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, we've allocated the money in this budget, the budget for the social marketing campaign aimed at young people to prevent them from taking up smoking. Mr. Speaker, as the strategy rolls out over the next year, we will assess on an annual basis what the revenue needs are to support the various measures in the strategy. Mr. Speaker, the province of Nova Scotia spends the second most per capita on their tobacco control efforts of any other province in the country, Mr. Speaker. And I think that that fact, Mr. Speaker, speaks for itself.
The Honourable Member for King's West.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, my question is for the Minister of Education. As the Minister is acutely aware, there is a serious issue that is plaguing the community of the Annapolis Valley. Countless media reports have been written about young individuals who have lost their lives and many still struggling to deal with addictions. One common thread when it comes to young people is the prevalence of farm parties where prescription drugs are taken in combination with alcohol. As many are aware, this can be a deadly combination, as we witnessed from a March death. My question to the minister: what is the minister doing from an education perspective to warn students about the dangers of farm parties?
The Honourable Minister of Education.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for that question. As you know, we have been greatly affected across the province with the use of drugs in our young people, and so I take this situation extremely seriously. I know that within our school system we have guidance counselors, and our teachers are talking about this with their students all of the time. It's a tragedy what we're going through in Nova Scotia with our young people and the choices that they're making. But I want everyone to know that we're taking this very, very seriously, and we're doing absolutely everything that we can to educate our young people not to take drugs and not to have this kind of activity. We will keep doing that and hope that it affects some kind of change. But what we really need to do too is hear from our youth to what we can do to support them and supporting each other and not going down this road. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for King's West, on your first supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, one of the most passionate crusaders I know when it comes to dealing with the tragedy associated with prescription drug addictions is Linda Dory. Her son, while waiting for treatment, tragically took his own life earlier this year. Yesterday, Linda traveled to Calgary to present at the Prime Minister's constituency office about the urgency of this issue. Being part of a group here in Nova Scotia who has been looking for support from the province for the past 16 months, she felt it important to take her message to the next level due to the lack of urgency on the part of the provincial government. My question to the Minister of Health and Wellness: will the minister agree to meet with Linda Dory to hear her story in order to ensure that any further government plans address the issue of timely treatment?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, this is an issue of great seriousness. Mr. Speaker, whenever a young person, has their life ended because of a drug overdose or any other tragedy, we all are very concerned, and we seek to understand what has occurred and what we can do as a society and as a government to address these issues. I have not had any contact from the lady that the member has raised. However, if she wishes to contact me and my office to request a meeting, we will certainly deal with that in the way that we deal with all requests for meetings with the minister, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Member for Kings West on your final supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, many in the community are concerned that Dr. Gould's report will spend too much time focusing on the deaths of individuals. They feel that more needs to be done to focus on concrete actions that will help people today. However, little has changed so far. Four people have approached my office in the last 7 days, all seeking treatment. Yesterday's most urgent case was passed on to the Provincial Director for Addiction Services, and all had to resort to investigating treatment through private options. My question to the Minister of Health and Wellness, will the Minister reassure the people of the Annapolis Valley that a concrete action plan will be part of Dr. Gould's interim report, scheduled to come out in the not-too-distant future?
The Honourable Minister of Health and Wellness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, what I've asked Dr. Gould to look at is not the deaths, but to look at the facts surrounding the situation that has been reported to me in the Annapolis Valley, and to make some recommendations with respect to addressing the situation as he is able to establish it. And I'm looking forward to receiving those recommendations in the next few days, Mr. Speaker, and at which time we will be able to move forward on this. Thank you.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Premier. Mr. Speaker, today the Premier announced a $1,800,000 incentive to Toronto Dominion Insurance, a division of the Toronto Dominion Bank Group, hoping to have them create 140 jobs here in Nova Scotia. This appears to be a new policy of the government, Mr. Speaker, because previously when they wanted to give money to insurance companies, they were providing incentives to companies like Marsh or Flagstone Reinsurance, which are offshore insurance providers. Now they're giving $1,800,000 to the Toronto Dominion Bank, which is a direct competitor of the insurance providers here in Nova Scotia. I should add, Mr. Speaker, that the Toronto Dominion Bank made a profit last year of $4.6 billion and compete directly with the 1,100 insurance brokers of the province of Nova Scotia. And so my question to the Premier is this: why are Toronto Dominion Bank jobs more valuable to his government than the 1,100 Nova Scotia brokers who provide the same service here at home?
Honourable the Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I wish the leader of the Conservative Party had been at the announcement today. Mr. Speaker, TD Insurance, has been in Nova Scotia since 1996. They started with a small operation with just 7 jobs. They've grown it to 165. They were looking to expand to work regionally, and this is a group that works on its insurance business on an inbound basis, so it's not calling out, it's receiving inbound calls, and they had a choice of the places that they could go to create those jobs. These are very significant, well-paying jobs, Mr. Speaker. So they're going to create an additional 140 jobs over the next number of years, and we think that that's good for Nova Scotians. It's good for the young people going to get the jobs there. It's good for our economy.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party on your first supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The fact of the matter is that the 1,100 jobs that are done by the insurance brokers of Nova Scotia are also very important and valuable jobs in our province. TDI may have been in our province since 1996, but the fact of the matter is that the law prevents the Toronto Dominion Bank from directly selling insurance. And in fact, as the Premier will remember, even over the internet, the federal Minister of Finance put in place some pretty tough restrictions on the ability to sell insurance if you're a bank over the internet. And if you'll indulge me for a moment, Mr. Speaker, the reason is quite important to know, because people who are going to a bank to borrow money are very financially vulnerable, and that is why they're being protected from the sale of insurance at that moment when they're applying for a loan. This is an important principle of our financial services industry that is designed to protect consumers. And so my question to the Premier is this. Given that the government wants to give $1,800,000 to the Toronto Dominion Bank to provide this service in direct competition with Nova Scotia brokers, why is he siding with the bank and not on the side of consumers who deserve that legal protection?
Honourable the Premier.
No, Mr. Speaker, in the first part of his question, he actually made my point. This is not the bank. They are not competing with the brokers. TD Insurance is of course, a separate organization from the bank. And, Mr. Speaker, this is a regional operation. It just doesn't operate in Nova Scotia. It's going to operate regionally. It's going to create 140 good jobs here in this province. And, Mr. Speaker, today I met with young people who were graduates of St. Mary's, of Dalhousie, some of whom came from other countries to Nova Scotia, who are going to stay because they've got a good job with TDI. This is important for the economy, and I think the leader of the Conservative Party should acknowledge it.
The Honourable Leader of the Progressive Conservative Party on your final supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the 1,100 jobs that are currently done by Nova Scotians are also important jobs. And in fact, the protection of consumers of insurance is also important. I will just share with the Premier this quote from Ken Myers, the chair of the Insurance Brokers Association. The banks ought not to be able to sell insurance at the point of granting credit. The reason is obvious. That is not a fair point to be selling insurance. And so my question to the Premier is this. Those 1,100 brokers have not asked nor received any incentive for the work that they do in Nova Scotia, for the jobs that they provide all across our province, Mr. Speaker, for the profits that they return to their communities. Why is this government so determined to incent banks and not our own insurance brokers?
Honourable the Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, first, again, this is TD Insurance. I want to point out that it was not a question of whether or not this work was going to take place. It was going to take place. The competition that exists among the various insurance companies was still going to be there. The only question was where the jobs were going to be located for young people to have. And in this case, because of the work that this government has done with TDI, those jobs are going to be located here. Those young people are going to be able to stay here. They are going to be able to build their lives here, Mr. Speaker. They are going to be able to raise their families here, and that's what's important.
The Honourable Member for Richmond.
Mr. Speaker, last night Halifax Regional Council joined our call in requesting that the provincial government adopt a strategy to deal with the recent increase in violent crime in our province. Recent shootings, stabbings, and murders have alarmed Nova Scotians. Rather than make new investments in crime prevention strategies in this year's budget, the NDP government saw fit to cut the Department of Justice budget by $5.35 million. And my question is, how can the Minister of Justice justify cutting $475,000 from the discretionary crime prevention and restorative justice budget?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank you, the member, for the question. The answer to the question is very simple. We didn't cut that. What we did, and I explained in the answer yesterday, and there should be correspondence delivered to him today in regards to that matter. What happened is that we had a number of programs or projects where money was being spent that came to an end, and that's where the money is from.
The Honourable Member for Richmond on your first supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, for the information of the House, the Minister of Justice saw fit to put out a cheap press release today accusing me of being misleading. And ironically, it comes from the NDP caucus office, not from the Department of Justice, which I think tells you how much weight should be given to this release. But let's go back to the Red Room, where the justice estimates were held. And let's go on Thursday, April 28, 2011, where I said, am I correct here in seeing that for the grants of discretionary crime prevention and restorative justice, you've cut that by 55.4%? That's over half of the budget for crime prevention that has been cut. Is that correct? And the answer that we received,
First off, any cut to crime prevention is a sad day. However, you have to make decisions and you have to take some action. I'm a big proponent of crime prevention, but we have to live within our means and we have to make good, wise choices with the dollar we put in. So I asked the Minister of Justice, when I said that this government cut crime prevention funding by 55.4%, exactly how was that misleading?
The Honourable Minister of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And just to, there's a number of points that he made there in his question. I thank him for the question. First off, I didn't want to, on the issue of doing the press release, which clearly answers some of the questions that he put forward. I did it through the caucus office. I didn't want to really waste my office's time because we've answered it several times to him. And therefore, the answer was given When the member makes false accusations in the paper, they do need to be responded to. But just to give some clarity to some points, is that when a project comes to an end, is that party over there saying that we take taxpayers' money and spend it on a program just because we did it in the past? But let me point out that this department has spent money on Safer Communities Neighborhoods Program, that the municipal police and the RCMP funding has been maintained for officers. The domestic violent court pilot project in Sydney has gone ahead. Civilian-led investigative unit has gone forward. Extra staff and equipment at Burnside has been put in place. A new correction facility in Pictou County is going ahead. Good legislation dealing with body armor. Mr. Speaker, I could go on and on and on about the things that this department has done. We have been constructive and achieved many things, and this member would do well to look at it.
The Honourable Minister for Richmond on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, Nova Scotians are demanding that this government invest in strategies to put an end to the violent crime that's taking place in this province, to put an end to the shootings, to the stabbings, and to the murders that we are seeing place. Last night we heard it from Halifax Regional Council. Mr. Speaker, the facts are this minister had an opportunity to take $475,000 and put it in anti-crime strategies to make Nova Scotia streets safer. Instead, he chose to send it to the Minister of Finance rather than reinvest it in his own department. So I ask the minister again, why did you allow a 55.4% cut in anti-crime strategies at a time when so much violence is taking place in this province?
Order, please, again. I don't know how I'm going to get this point across again. I mean, I know we're going to keep working on it, but it's coming to the point that, you know, I said that, you know, in all Westminster-based parliaments, please start using, you know, the third person or going through the chair and stop using the word you. So I will now go to the Minister of Justice for his answer. The Minister of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And once again, I'd like to point out that my colleague across there would rather create fear rather than to take the responsibility in the community to speak positively about things that are happening. Mr. Speaker, may I continue?
Please do.
Mr. Speaker, this morning I made an announcement on the civil forfeitures, and you can't make the link that if you take the assets and the resources away from the criminals, that the behavior will go down. He can't make the connection between the violence and the money. It's unfortunate that he's limited in his ability to comprehend that concept, but we will work overtime with him to make sure he gets the information.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for the Minister of Community Services. Mr. Speaker, on February 17th, I sent a letter to the Minister of Community Services expressing concern over the lack of day programming for individuals with severe physical and cognitive disabilities. Now, I would like to thank the Minister for her response, and her letter included a list of adult service centres which provide day programming for persons with disabilities. The Minister said, quote, "Currently, there are several centres that offer day programming for individuals with high needs ranging from mobility issues, nonverbal, vision issues, require mechanical lifts and behavioural issues," unquote. The Minister did not, however, outline which specific centres provide services for individuals with severe needs. So, Mr. Speaker, would the Minister of Community Services please name a specific or specific centres which provide these services to individuals with severe needs?
The Honourable Minister of Community Services.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The day programs in the province are very important for the people with disabilities. It's one area that unfortunately there hasn't been a concentration of funding over the years, and therefore this government has put in funding. The last 2 weeks ago, we made an announcement to increase the dollars into day programs because some of the areas, as the member would know, that we do need to focus on are the areas where people have higher needs and to be able to provide them with those services. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth East on your final supplementary.
Well, Mr. Speaker, first, it's like this. I wrote a letter to the minister asking her about a case with somebody with severe disabilities. The minister sent back a list of adult service programs and not or service centers, and not a single one on that list actually provides the services which were required by this individual or which I wrote the letter to the minister about. Mr. Speaker, when the constituent in question, Ms. Shelley Maxwell, read the minister's letter, she called them all. And she responded, quote, "I find it interesting that the directory of adult service centers that were listed are ones that we have already been in touch with, and none are in a position to accept individuals like Megan," unquote. Mr. Speaker, the minister will remember from the letter that Megan is tube-fed, nonverbal, and has no access to day programming, as a result is forced to be at home most days. Mr. Speaker, will the minister acknowledge that there are significant gaps in the current system for individuals with severe disabilities, and the list that she sent did not address the question that the constituent was asking about?
The Honourable Minister of Community Services.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. The important piece of knowledge that the Honourable Member has to realize is that there are issues out there with day programs because of a lack of investment over the years, and we're working very hard to make a difference. We are meeting with day program people, and every one of the day program service providers that we have in the province, it looks at each case individually, and there is no problem for this member to come to our department and to discuss that with us if the situation has been that this particular individual has not been able to find the services that are needed. Then we can look at that and see what we can do, and what we do is we provide a list, because each day service provider has different programs that they offer, and so they need to have the information. That's why I provided the list, because then they can go and talk to them to see if that particular service is available for their loved ones. Thank you.
The Honourable Member for Dartmouth on your final supplementary.
Mr. Speaker, I find the minister's answer, quite frankly, baffling, because the whole point of my letter was very clear to the minister that the reason we were writing is because there was a problem that we could not find the services. And so we did go back to the department, and the minister's department's answer was, put Megan in a nursing home. Well, Mr. Speaker, that is unacceptable. This is a family that wants to care for their daughter at home. All they're looking for is support and day programs, yet this minister's department seems more willing to spend more money and have the government spend more money putting this young woman in a nursing home instead of providing the necessary services. So, Mr. Speaker, will the minister commit to finding a solution that offers Megan and people like Megan day programming without forcing them into nursing homes?
The Honourable Minister of Community Services.
Mr. Speaker, one point I would like to make is that most members in this House, when they have an issue, they have come and they have spoken to me personally. And I have taken every step that is possible to work with each and every member here. So instead of sending a letter, if he's not happy with the response, he can come and talk to me about it. That is the adult way of doing business to help others, not stand in this House and rag on somebody about programs and such that we are working really, really hard to make a difference. Come talk to me and let's find out what the solution is. We're a solution-oriented government. He may not be, but we are.
The Honourable Member for Digby-Annapolis.
I find some long-winded answers from over there, Mr. Speaker. But I only want a short one. If I got time here to get one short answer from the Minister of Energy, I'll be pleased. Mr. Speaker, recently we've been told that hundreds of turbines, tidal turbines, can be installed in the next few years in the Bay Fundy. This is good for the environment, but we're also good for economic development. If the provincial government supports the municipality of Digby in its hard work to make this area the port of choice for maintenance on these turbines. My question to the minister is, does the NDP government support Digby in its efforts to become the port of choice for tidal turbine maintenance over St. John, New Brunswick?
The Honourable Minister of Energy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the Honourable Member for the question, and certainly the Fundy Offshore Tidal Project is very important to this province, and you know, it's a huge investment by a number of companies to look at tidal power in the Bay of Fundy, where more water comes in there than all the rivers in the world, and it gives a tremendous opportunity to invest in our tidal energy. But Digby is a beautiful area of our province, and I would encourage the Honourable Member to work with our department to make that happen.
The Honourable Member for Digby Annapolis on your
I'll direct this question to the Minister of Economic Development, Mr. Speaker. My question for the Minister is, will the Minister of Economic Development push this initiative at the Cabinet table and help to bring much-needed economic development to the Digby and surrounding areas in this new tidal initiative?
The Honourable Minister of Economic and Rural Development and Tourism.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, to you, the answer is yes, I will.
Thank you. The time allotted for oral questions put by members to ministers has elapsed.
This podcast was previously aired on Legislative Television. The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purposes of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these televised proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.